We'll synchronize ourselves here. This should be an Olympic event.
Synchronized recording.
Manzares of Firaxis Games, and like me, you're listening to Polycast, the official podcast of Apolyton Civilization site.
Welcome to the 24th edition of Polycast, the official podcast of Apolyton Civilization site. We tried to get 100% less Dan Q, but unfortunately he's a hard bugger to get rid of. Joining me is the named Dan Q, unfortunately. Don't tell him, we're going to knock him off after the show. Say hi, Dan.
Hi, Dan. As opposed to a soft bugger, I'm not really sure we want to go there, but okay.
This is a family show, Dan.
Yeah, right.
Oh, actually, we'd be calling him Dan Q, because we have more than one Dan. Also joining us is Ming, the Destroyer.
I thought I was the Merciless.
Of souls.
Yeah.
I don't know, branching out. Also joining us is Maka Ula. I don't know.
What? Who?
Makalua. Also joining us is Makalua, coming back from one of her hot dates on Girls Who Play Civ.com.
No. Yeah, my hot date with a list of errands.
Oh, errands. Ooh, tell us about that. Also joining us is Solver.
Hi.
Enthusiasm.
Lots of enthusiasm.
And Dan T.
Hey, everybody.
Wow, someone is actually calling my house right now. I wonder if I should answer and say, don't you know I'm recording a podcast? How rude.
Why don't you ask them if they want to be a part of Polycast? Like that one guy who called in that you called back on our Skype account.
Actually, that was two people I did that to.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Martin, you still haven't called back in. What's going on?
But there's one that you actually put on the front of most Polycasts.
What was that?
You called Polycast. I don't suppose you're a Civilization fan.
Civilization?
A computer game.
No.
That very British understated way.
Dan's very best hour.
So what are we waiting for here?
I don't know.
Christmas.
What year?
2013.
All right, let's get it on.
What? Hey now, this is a...
Someone wants to talk to Dan. All right, news time.
Woo-hoo. IGN releases a Civilization 4 Beyond the Sword guide of sorts. Soren Johnson on why Alpha Centauri's unit workshop failed.
Modcast time?
Yep.
Yay!
Introducing military civics to Civ 4, gripes about the game's Crystal Redentor and Sistine Chapel wonders.
Shall we move to the Senate?
Are Sid Sushi and Mining Inc. the best BTS corporations? Optimal distances between cities and Civ 4. What good are submarines? Favorite unrestricted leader combo courtesy Beyond the Sword. I speak with Civilization 4 Gold Edition poster artist Greg Hildebrand in the second of a three-part interview. Archived Senate discussion from episode 23, How Big a Civ 4 Army is Big Enough? Archived Time Machine retrospective from episode 9, The Release of Alpha Centauri.
Dan has this new Beyond the Sword game guide. The guide is written by J. Pyro Falcon Habib, and he is trying to explain Beyond the Sword to us peons and how we love it so.
His new nickname is Clueless.
Was it that bad?
It's not good. And I don't even really play. I'm like, that's wrong. If I'm saying that's wrong.
Yeah, it's kind of Civ for dummies.
Yeah, it really is. It's like, you've never played Civ before.
Actually, it's not even that.
If first thing, the overview, is they try to explain the four X's. Like, explore. Humans didn't know what the whole world looked like. People explored. And I'm like, are you kidding me?
What got me is that they suggest that the Aztecs are one of the best tips for a culture victory.
Wow.
Oh, and they get the domination criteria wrong.
And the analysis of America starts off by saying, woohoo, USA, USA, USA. I'm not even making that up. I can't make that up. I wonder where IGN's from.
They're probably disappointed they only got half of their advice wrong. They're probably going for three quarters.
Oh, they're doing it to create controversy, so they'll get a lot of emails saying, what the hell is wrong with you?
And in their list of civilizations, they don't even think that the traits are worth mentioning. You'll see that for each civilization, they mention only the starting technologies and the unique unit. It still manages to insult the French, of course, which is every American's duty, it would seem. The quality of that which is French culture can be debated.
Oh!
In another highlight, the IGN guide says that Pericles is one of the worst leaders in the game. Apparently a combination of philosophical and creative is not good enough for him.
He needs more. Maybe he's playing the Chinese game and he's playing the Chinese folk.
He needs Dale's mod.
Yeah.
The Incans and Zulus are the weakest two civilizations in the game. About Incans. In other words, they suck, and no amount of gold they make will change that.
Send out hate mail.
Yeah.
Foolish earlier.
Seriously, where is the hate mail address?
This is a nice new tradition of the show to mock various reviewers, guide writers.
When they're this bad.
We mocked a reviewer before, the one that thought Warlords had more content than Beyond the Sword, so that was one.
Yeah, that's the problem.
You know what's funny? Like, this guy actually posts on our site or something. He starts listening to Polycast, like, hey!
Dan only does that because he knows that no one listens.
That's why he tries to have a lot of guests, figure they'll listen.
Maybe it's Dan writing this.
No, even Dan knows more than this.
Yay!
Even Dan. Oh, I'm reading the expand part of this Beyond the Sword guide. It's like, don't build too close to other cities. You might take away other resources. Like, does anyone not know that? Or
like I said, set for dummies.
Who exactly is he writing this for? Yeah.
Everybody's welcome to their opinion, even if they're morons.
And here's the best piece about that guide. IGN says that bureaucracy is actually better than free speech for cultural victories.
What?
Excuse me?
What mod are they playing?
What part of 100% culture did they not see?
Yeah, it's apparently too late in the game for them.
Oh.
I feel I must say again, bureaucracy, boo. Controversy, yes.
Controversy.
So anything else we can trash in a bit?
There are far too many pages of crap.
Yeah. I'm clicking along, like, come on now.
Oh, it's going to get better. No, not this page. Oh, it's going to get better. No, it's worse again.
No.
Oh, thank goodness it's done. That's the good part. It does end.
Yay. Woohoo.
See, we said something positive after all.
One thing the answer to is Smack Unit Workshop. I'm thinking, is it why I didn't do it for Civ 4?
Or why Firaxis viewed Smack's Unit Workshop as a failure for Civ 4 or any future title.
The problem was the graphics in terms of all generic, and what they really wanted was something to emphasize difference between, say, a Bierman or an Axeman or something like that. And it's easier to distinguish them just looking at them rather than having to put your mouse over it to see exactly what type of unit it is, so you know whether it's a tachyon squad or a trained tachyon squad or a trained chaos invader. And they all look the same.
I think we've moved beyond whether or not something looks like a spearman or a tank, though. We don't have to worry about that anymore.
Yes. Well, I don't know. They both either can defeat the other, so.
Solver, I believe you may have some comments on this.
Actually, you should ask Dan T.
Really? Smack? I actually never had the pleasure of playing the game, although I worried about something that intricate actually paying off and actually working. I think when you have that many options, it's hard to imagine all of them being good options. It's hard to imagine that there wouldn't just be one best unit to design and then all these other things are just kind of useless. I might be wrong, though.
Yeah, it's the Planet Buster.
Okay.
That's the best unit.
That's precisely because you've never played the game. You can appreciate the C4 promotion system in a way the rest of us can't. Because Soren said that the promotion system is a natural evolution of the unit workshop. And those of us who played Alpha Centauri, we always compare promotions to the unit workshop. You do not have that bias, so you probably understand promotions better.
Yeah, I think it's easier to balance 30 or 40 military units and then balance like a promotion tree than it is to balance like, I don't know, hundreds of little gadgets you can hook up together or something. I don't know how it works though, so I could be totally wrong.
No, you're right, because you can hit on combinations that totally don't work at all, or you can hit on combinations just so uber powerful that you just run over the rest of the AI, or even your fellow players.
Yeah, so in the end, all this added choice really doesn't pay off, because you end up with one or two choices that are the best anyway.
And of course, the AI always designed the same units in every game, and that was totally boring.
Yeah, that's the other thing. The AI can't utilize the unit workshop as well as the AI uses promotions in Civ.
I wish we could compare this to the ship designer, ship builder in Galactic Civilizations 2, but I think Solver knows more about that game than anyone else on the panel, I believe.
Choose weapons, engines, and defenses. Those are the key three components. But it works maybe a little bit like the unit workshop, but it works well because there are not so many components and you don't have special abilities. Alpha Centauri had lots of special abilities, and you could have two of those, so in the end there was a whole host of completely useless and completely strange combinations. The Galciv 2 designer, of course, it offers absolutely fantastic abilities for those who like to design cool-looking ships, but the strategy, it is simple enough so the AI is not completely killed by it. I'm quite happy that the new BTS AI managed to surprise some people, in particular with its amphibious assaults. People had gotten used to protecting their coastal cities with one or two units, and then the AI simply comes out of nowhere, declares war and attacks and takes over that city immediately. It definitely created some surprise responses, and that is a real mark of success, showing that the AI had really been improved this time around.
Welcome to the Modcast, where we talk about hot issues in the forums.
All right, let's talk about military civics, even though you did link to CFC.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept, but the way this guy laid it out doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense.
In a nutshell, that's very true.
In what way? Like, is it strategy you don't like, or is it the realism of it?
Well, I think Katie Katz's response, I think, was classic.
Yeah.
Yep, I agree.
And the one civic listed without boosting the cost, they have 200% war weariness, and war weariness is already lots higher on BTS. So I think that kind of sums it up. It's like, interesting concept. Maybe there could be a good military civic, but setting it up the way this does, it's like, okay, it adds nothing new to the game except for to screw the player more.
Yeah, I think a lot of the numbers are too big, and there's just too many numbers, in fact. I think they need to be simpler, and they need to be smaller.
And maybe the upkeep as well. Katie Caspo said the costs are already pretty high.
I know Dan T will back me up on this. It's a really big problem with civics. You can't just add them. It's very tempting. I know people like civics and they think civics can be added, but the problem is that every civic has to work well with every other civic, and in turn every possible combination has to work fine with every aspect of the game, from builder aspects to warmonger aspects. And as Dan T will confirm, during development, civics underwent a lot of changes, maybe more than anything else. So to add civics alone, it would require such a horrible amount of time and playtesting that I am, for example, very glad that Firaxis decided not to add any new civic sections for Beyond the Sword.
Yeah, exactly. I'm with Katie Cat also, who says that there are plenty of military civics already, like nationalism, vassalage, theocracy, police state, etc.
Exactly.
Regardless of whatever this person does with his military civics, I don't believe we need a separate military civics category. It's all better and best served under the existing civics categories.
What a great thing to discuss on a forum board, so we see it all the time.
I think like a first general issue, if we're actually going to look at these points specifically. Now, there are two drafts. Did everyone notice that there are actually two drafts? This person did not update their opening post with their suggestions, but followed up and made some changes based on the feedback that he had received.
But still, I don't think the changes make it any more appealing to me as a player.
No, me neither. Like the first issue, this default option militia. Everyone knows that our default civic options in Civ 4, we have low upkeep, but there are no benefits, but there are no negatives either. So right away, we're on balance. And I suppose one could say, well, maybe the other starting civic should have benefits or should have penalties. But that's an even bigger balancing consideration that's not something worth exploring, at least in Civ 4, but I kind of like it the way it is.
Yeah, it's actually a decision about making it fun strategy. Because if you make default civics with any kind of penalties, then you take one decision away from the player. As soon as you get the ability to switch civics, you absolutely need to eliminate those penalties. And that's an automatic decision, and any automatic decision in Civ is bad.
I think the problem is that the only military features you have to work with are experience, great generals, and upkeep, and it seems like all these civics are just different permutations of those three numbers, and it's just not enough to offer the same variety as, say, free speech versus bureaucracy. That seems like a much more interesting decision than, do I want two experience or three experience?
Yeah, I think there's too much of an emphasis on great general point benefits. There was someone who said, how do you balance peaceful and aggressive play styles? And the person who started this thread, the American, said that until volunteer military, standing armies and militias are for peaceful civilizations, and conscription and mercenaries are for aggressive civilizations.
I don't see that at all.
Yeah, I'm not buying it. To add more flavor to these civics, something like conscription could offer a certain amount of culture. I mean, not to be too much of a wonk here, but Machiavelli used to talk about how conscription was actually really great for building a national mythos and building a lot of national loyalty. So adding some other numbers in here besides just constantly fiddling with the great general points could make these more interesting.
Yeah, because the American stands by that the standing army should be one of the two military civics you should look at for peaceful civilizations, but the great general point boost is one of only two benefits of standing armies, and if you're not an aggressive player, what, like, whoopee.
What good is the 200% great general points if you're not going to attack anybody?
Exactly.
Maybe better than a military civics would be like a foreign policy or diplomacy civics, where you could choose between a more aggressive or isolationist or even peaceful stance.
And get benefits for it.
Absolutely.
Actually, that wouldn't be a bad civic to think about.
But that might be meaningless in multiplayer.
Cristo Redentor. At least there's an Apolitan one as well on this one, I'm telling you.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Kusi Walker, for saving us from CFC horribleness.
Wait, we're saving Kusi Walker?
Isn't that a shock? Let's thank the spammers.
I actually have a question about this wonder, because I've never been really good with the spiritual trait and being able to change civics constantly. Does it work the same way as spiritual, where you can only change it once per turn, or can you change it multiple times per turn?
Back and forth, back and forth.
Wow.
It's powerful.
The trait, I'm pretty sure it takes you 5 turns before you can make another change still, right?
I believe so.
Yeah.
Okay, this seems to me like a bug or an exploit. Hope they certainly didn't intend this. That seems really bad.
Seems like maybe they meant you that you can change it once a turn or something like that, but not multiple times during every turn. It still makes it powerful, but it's not exploity.
Yeah, this seems either short-sighted or just a big mistake.
Well, I like how the discussion on went from, you know, is it too powerful to how does it compare against using a golden age? Because a lot of people are planning their civic switches during that so they can take advantage of not losing the turn. a lot of the comparisons came between, okay, you can do it during the Golden Age, but it's not timed as well as you like. And the power of this, it was more of an interesting discussion. So I think it's just a matter of opinion whether it's too powerful or not, because I think the key point is it comes late in the game. It's not like this happens early in the game that you can get.
Mm-hmm. If it was earlier, it'd be ridiculous, but that is the key.
I'd be switching every second.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be switching every time. Oh, my building's coming out, I'm going to switch this. Oh, I got a unit coming out, I'm going to switch this. Oh, I got to change my religion so he doesn't attack me.
Mm-hmm.
Later in the game, those issues aren't as important.
But even if this isn't that powerful, it kind of irks me that you can change multiple times, like just before you produce a unit and then just before you do each little task. It doesn't seem like good gameplay to me. I mean, I guess some people like it, but I was hoping to play a game where they don't encourage that kind of calculation.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the person does say if you think some parts of it are exploitable, don't do it.
That's not a choice in an MP game, though. That's the problem.
That's true.
Yeah.
Unless you want to do some sort of house rule.
We try to limit the house rules in most of the MP games because there are some things that are exploitable, and it's just tough explaining all those things when you get new people.
That's true.
We encourage a lot of newbies to join our game, and you got to explain, okay, we try to remove, for example, the double attack exploit. So we say that when you declare war on somebody for the first turn, you have to wait for that person to say okay before you end your turn. Because that way you give the person at least a chance to respond to the initial attack. After that, no holds barred.
Mm-hmm.
But for that first attack, we say, hey, if you're going to declare war on somebody, you have to say, hey, are you ready for me to advance to try to eliminate that, of course, exploit? This would be a much tougher one to really take a look. Well, I guess the screen comes up, so it would be something that could be monitored. But the more and more rules you have to include for people to remember, the more difficult it is in an MP environment.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also the more house rules you have, just in any circumstance, tell someone, don't do something. If they hadn't thought about it before, now they are.
Oh.
So if they treated it just like they did the actual characteristic, then I think it's okay. But yeah, switching multiple times in the same turn just is garbage.
Yeah, the best argument against Christa Redentor being overpowered is some claim, as it's already mentioned, is how late in the game it arrived. It's not as a potential powerhouse victory-changing-wise as, you know, say, Pyramid since Vanilla, or maybe arguably even Great Wall since Warlords, or even now the Statue of Zeus, but it's still overpowered at present out of the box, especially with the Civic flip back and forth, and we've got to believe that that part at least is going to be addressed. You know that leaders who have the spiritual trait can construct it twice as quickly. Now who's going to say that the spiritual trait is useless? Hmm?
Why, you're going to use an engineer anyway.
People who don't like to play spiritual?
I'm not a spiritual fan, but we know there are spiritual fans out there, so at least until a patch.
Where it gets nerfed.
Yes.
Yes. Some nerfs are good nerfs.
I think this is more than a nerf. This is like just fixing a straight-up mistake.
Matten says he doesn't think, again, it's quite powerful because it's available at such a late stage in the game, but then, as the appropriately named Empire Maker observes, it is problematic and enticing on advanced starts, where there really isn't that concern about it being available later in the game once you've been going. Not that I'm an advanced starts person, but anyway. He says, quote, "It was wonderful when I attacked. I had 10,000 plus gold in the bank and just went on a rush buy festival."
Hey.
Yeah, and Dante, if you say that's a mistake, that's something you should have spotted before the game was released. And me too, of course.
Invisible Stock argues that the only thing that stops this wonder from being incredibly powerful is how close it is to mass media and the technology tree. If the AI gets the United Nations, then you end up getting your civic options limited pretty quickly. Well, I think most critically here in Beyond the Sword, you can defy UN resolutions. I realize there's a big happiness hit for that, but...
Oh, no kidding.
But still...
And that needs to be fixed as well, by the way.
Well, I know it's not realistic, but pretty much if you can defy the UN without too much of a penalty, the UN becomes useless, which might actually be realistic, but it's just, I don't know. I feel like they have two choices. They can either make it work or they can make it realistic.
Well, did you see that one thread where they had the civ that was constantly going against the UN and all of the cities were down to size one?
Oh, wow.
Huh.
It's a classic screen save.
Yeah, it's a little ridiculous, but I don't know. I feel like the UN is just totally out of place in this game. It's just impossible to make it work.
Part 2, the Sistine Chapel Ridiculous. basically saying now the Sistine Chapel gives +5 culture to all state religion buildings, and therefore it's overpowered, he's saying, and others are saying, well, no, it's not necessarily overpowered.
I feel the same way about the new Sistine Chapel as I would about a wonder that would say, cut the domination threshold in half or by 20% or something. It just doesn't seem right to me. I couldn't really explain why, but it just seems like bad gameplay and just bad for the victory conditions in general.
Yeah, no, it's Thyrin, or however we want to pronounce it. He says, combined with the apostolic palace, it is really gross. Make your state religion the same as the AP in your temples and monasteries. Give an additional +5 culture and +2 hammer.
I think that's an interesting point, although it's kind of separate from the Sistine Chapel by itself. But I think that maybe there might be too much power in religion right now.
Yeah, well, thanks to what Sistine Chapel sets up here, and in combination with all of those others, yes, it is really quite powerful. If you're not able to found a religion, you definitely want religion to spread so you can take advantage of these and start building those religious buildings. Which, of course, I guess is the only case is you might not want to get these buildings as if even if you adopt a state religion, whether you found one or not, if you're not building religious buildings, then I guess you would ignore this, although I don't know why you would. Even if you're a warmonger, because at some point, especially if you've got really powerful cultural neighbors, you want to try to beat them off with a stick somehow.
Best way to do that is just to crash and burn their cities. You got a culture problem? Remove the problem. And if you think the Sistine Chapel is too powerful, find the city, raise it. There's a simple solution to all these problems.
I still think it's a problem with the four in general that maybe this wonder highlights. Culture is pretty much meaningless. Unless you're going for a culture victory, culture only has two meanings. One is the first border expansion that you need to work your fat cross, and the second is in some border cities that are actively contesting culture of other cities. Otherwise, well, it doesn't really matter. Your core cities, whether they have 3,000 culture or 4,000 or even 300, it doesn't make any difference.
Ultimately, if you're down and out on one of both of these things, whether it's the Cristo Redentor or the Sistine Chapel, you're likely rarely on the giving end of the benefits of one or both. But most importantly, you're forgetting Civilization II's Leonardo Workshop. Oh, yeah.
In the end, I think that the public response to espionage in Beyond the Sword is overall quite encouraging. People seem to have liked the passive espionage system, which I also think is the best part. It seems that there is only one major problem with espionage as it's shipped, which of course is the quite unfortunate effect of water poisoning and unhappiness missions on marathon speeds. I definitely have myself partially to blame for that, because it's not something I spotted before release. But on the other hand, fortunately, it's a simple enough problem to fix for the patch.
Welcome to the Senate. In this section, we talk about game strategy.
Best corporations. This guy says, Verlund's his name is, believes that Sid Sushi and Mining Incorporated are the best corporations, and he wants us to agree. And apparently a lot of them like Sid Sushi.
And this whole discussion is based on whether you even like corporations or not. It's a good way to drive your opponents crazy. Let them spread it and screw themselves while you get all the money.
So in other words, it's a lot like real life.
Yeah, really, Sid Sushi, it's very special in that you can use the corporation in an astounding amount of ways. Because the primary benefit here is food, and food is probably the most conversible of Civ4 resources. You can literally turn it into anything you want. You can make your cities larger, or you can use the food to fund extra specialists, and there are specialists for every resource. So you can turn that food into hammers, into gold, into research, or an extra population, or through drafting even in extra units. No other corporation offers this many choices.
There's also a good point that there's a lot more seafood on the board.
Yeah, there's way more seafood.
I think that's been raised in a couple of threads. There's a lot of excess seafood, whereas you don't necessarily get that with the land-based food special sometimes.
Yeah, people like the new maps in Beyond the Sword.
To Solver's point, I think there's just a lot more versatility that comes from production and research, as opposed to like something like Sib Jewelers that gives culture, or I think there's one that gives you research, right? The ethanol one?
Yeah.
So food is probably the best, because as the said, you can turn it into anything.
Yeah.
Far more flexible.
Yeah, there was one user here, Thalassicus or whatever.
You're doing good on these names.
I know. I'm very skilled, or something. And I'm skilled at screwing them up.
Keep that hate mail coming.
All right. Hate mail.
At least you have some skills.
Woo-hoo. Tells an interesting tale of sushi's benefits. He says he's turning a profit at his current game, again, by gobbling up all those spare seafood resources in the world through trade. At one point, he's updated a couple of times. He's got plus 17 food, plus 65 culture, plus free specialists per city.
Wow.
Yeah, then again, you can see the guy has 20 fish and I think that's 18 clam sources. So it was probably quite difficult to get that much. He must have conquered half the world to get all these resources.
Again, there's a simple solution. If your competition has it, raise the city. You have to understand, I'm an MP player. That's the solution to everything. Raise it.
Now, Mice does warn and caution, what if your trade situation changes drastically through war? You will be left with maintenance costs and have to change those workshops back to farms to prevent starving. Because of the food benefit, he got rid of his farms and changed them to workshops for production benefit.
Try that in an MP game. That won't work. We'd eat this guy for lunch. Again, from the MP community side, there really isn't any upside on the corporations. They never get used. Nobody dares do it. And if somebody tries spreading them, there's simple solutions like changing civics to make sure they can't.
Yes.
And of course, the default fallback position, raise it.
You bet.
I'm going to raise you like I should. Okay. Then. Oh.
No singing.
I would ask, do you think since they called it Sid Sushi that they made it more powerful knowing it was going to be the best one? Because it does have the best name. Come on.
Yeah, and it's Sid's name.
Exactly. I think it's kind of a fix-in. Of course it has to be the best corp. They named it after Sid.
There you go.
Yeah, Civilized Jewelers is an okay name, but Mining Inc., yawn.
There's an exciting one.
Optimal distances between cities. I'm not sure.
Most boring discussion of all time.
Yeah, that's a weird topic here.
I think Morgrod's answer is the best. The answer to how far apart cities should be, however far apart they should be. I know that's not very helpful, but he's right. It depends on the map. It depends on your situation. It depends on what you're trying to accomplish. I mean, there is no answer to this question. Look at the board, moron.
It depends on where your resources. It depends on what type of city you want.
Exactly.
I mean, it's very flexible.
You practically need a flowchart.
Yeah, we need a flowchart. Every city should be optimally three spaces apart, allowing absolutely no overlap with the crosshairs.
Is your city close to water? Yes or no?
Water. Good.
I know for me, in Civ 2 or 3, I used to try to minimize the amount of gaps between my cities, but it seems like in Civ 4, I do a lot more resource chasing. So I end up with these pretty big gaps between some of my cities, but it pays off. It works out pretty good.
You can always backfill later.
Yeah.
Remember the city spammers in Civ 2 where every city was two squares apart? You know, that seemed to be the optimal strategy if you bought into that spam theory.
Ah, yes.
Here, the options are, hey, it's wherever you need to put a city down.
Mm-hmm.
You need copper. You need horses. You need sushi. Come on. You put the city down. You don't count how many squares it is away.
Well, this is this many tiles and that.
Oh, I have to put the city here. It doesn't matter that there's nothing here that I'd want to build a city for, but damn it, it's three squares away. What a terrible discussion.
Now, I will say for me, I prefer to have it so that my city's fat crosses don't overlap. However, most of the time, or certainly some of the time, that's either unrealistic, either because of the map type you have, for example, or just either for control of strategic resources or for strategic land, like a choke point between two continents or even large islands.
Hmm.
I think the real question is how close should your city be next to the strategic resource that you're trying to attack?
Overlap isn't even so bad in Civ 4. You can just assign a specialist.
Yeah, some people, like for copper early on, they'll build their city right on top of the copper to make sure somebody can't come up and take advantage of it by building the city even closer. I mean, that's a better discussion than how far apart should my cities be? Oh, joy. Let's talk about that for 12 pages. Let them. And if you don't like how close your cities are, you go raise your opponents. Doesn't quite work.
I find that the AI puts a lot more cities closer together than I do. That doesn't really work out too well for them, though.
Yeah, it makes it easier to conquer them fast.
Twice the space, half the cities.
There you go.
Yeah, more cities to raise.
Okay.
Next!
I knew that would be a short topic. We need at least one.
It was just screaming as a short topic. Right up there with what good are submarines?
They kill battleships. Isn't that what they're good for? They kill battleships.
Actually, they're very good for distributing spies and other things to your... And I love how they talk about, I often build several subs with flanking and sentry, and then leave them in sentry mode outside some of my borders. Woo! They must get late in the game and they have nothing better to do than to line up submarines around their continent to protect them. Yeah, and 22 boats come up, and what is that submarine going to do? They're coming! They're coming! Oh, joy. Another unit outside your cultural border costing you money.
Yeah. I mean, I'll build a few submarines at key points along my borders, because I'll wake up if a ship, or more likely, as someone says, several ships come within their visibility range. And I think they are good for transporting spies, and it is nice that they can hide under ice floes if they get attacked. Or transport that's not defended, although I really don't even see that. Even before Beyond the Sword and the changes to naval warfare. Although Gaius Octavius thinks that in... Beyond the Sword, submarines are necessities because they carry tactical nukes, which allows you to launch a surprise nuclear attack on enemies without them knowing what hit them. Missile cruisers can do that too, but they're not invisible.
So we can take a submarine and pull a Hunt for Red October?
That'd be great. This submarine's actually a fake. A submarine who's defecting to you. Yes.
Submarines just seem much better in real life than they do in Civ, so...
I actually don't know a lot about real-life military. What are subs good for in real life that you can't do with a good boat?
Well, they can hide better.
Yeah, like I said, under ice floes. Yay, when they get damaged.
They're meant to take out carriers and larger surface ships. You know, what the heck. And then you have your strategic force, which is there to drop nukes.
That makes sense. I wonder why they didn't try to do it that way, balance the unit with that kind of purpose in mind.
I just think they're not strong enough to take on larger surface ships.
You think they need a boost?
Well, yeah, I mean, against battleships, they're not all that good.
Yeah, there's no surprise attack promotion or something that would give them that extra strength bonus, because that's where their strength lies. They get that first shot.
Yeah, and also as a standoff weapon. They didn't actually have to go toe-to-toe with the battleship. They sat off from a distance and dropped some torpedoes in the water, and then dived.
I guess you could think of them as aquatic snipers.
There's not much a battleship can do against a submarine. Let's get real here. Take on a submarine, you need destroyers, or you need air-launched depth charges, so a carrier or a destroyer can handle a sub. In this game, a battleship can just take a sub right out. That's realistic.
Yeah, it would make World War II a whole lot different.
Let's go on to the favorite unrestricted leader combo.
Oh man, anything with Rome is a killer. Especially when you get, who's that person with the charismatic combo?
Boudica.
Yeah, that's right.
Not my favorite playing combo or anything.
That's a nightmare. Yeah, I don't usually use this feature, but just off the top of my head, it seemed like a real bad idea. But, you know, it offers some variety and some fun if you like steamrolling over your competition very easily.
And some do.
I think it's funny that they took all the time to balance all the different civilizations, or you think they did. And then they throw in an option like this that allows for some of the most biggest imbalances there are. You get to take the best traits of all worlds there.
Didn't we find out last episode who we could blame for that?
Well, like I said, but then again, it goes back to, I think, one of our initial discussions. It allows flexibility. It allows people to do what they want. Frankly, I don't care what people do with the game in SP. To me, it's like they bought the game. It's there for enjoyment. Any way that you can make it more enjoying for them is a good experience and a good thing. In MP, we usually play random anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think this is a good feature, just so long as it doesn't become a default and doesn't become a mainstream, like, this is the way that Civ is meant to be played kind of feature. I think it's best kept to the fringes where people get bored of game balance and want to try the steamroller.
Well, I think a lot of people are annoyed that they want the best of all possible worlds. You know, they want that little leg up, and they're not willing to take the bad that goes along with the good. So they cheat.
Yeah, to me, that's an important part of challenge, and I really enjoy that challenge. That's why I don't really use this feature that much.
I've never used the feature. And I've never seen it used in an MP game either.
Yeah, me either. I'm not surprised.
Because everybody would take the same things.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, a lot of the MP games, it's now broken down to everybody plays random. Because for a while there, I think, under Warlords, for example, when everybody was able to pick their own leader, you'd start the game and there'd be seven Incas.
Oh, yeah, the whole thing with the yellow Inca and the purple Inca.
So now we just play random anyway, so it's more fun that way. So we're in agreement that it's a great feature in the game, and it gives players what they want, but many of us don't use it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's about right.
For me, Wouter would be happy with this. William Varangia, I might even be pronouncing that properly now. Woo!
That would be a first.
Hey, now, as either leader of the Romans for the Praetorians or the Vikings for their Berserkers.
I think Berserkers are underrated.
Yes, they are, and that's why I'm going to promote them here. Berserkers, Berserkers.
No, I think you can come up with some fantastic combinations by just exactly as you're saying. You get the best of all worlds. What fun is that? There's a reason why they balance the leaders in the first place, even though some of them do suck.
Yeah, I'm just glad that they added this feature in an expansion pack, so that way they kind of force people to play a real balanced game the way that it's sort of meant to be played. And then finally, now that people might be getting a little bit bored of it, it's like, you know what, let's just open it up and see if that gives you some more to have fun with.
Mm-hmm.
Why not, right?
Again, in an SP mode, anything that would enhance the enjoyment of any player is a good thing. We don't have to use it. It's an option.
Beyond the Sword really stands out in the mods it included. Previous Civ 4 games, that is, Civ 4 itself and Warlords, all had mods, but they widely ranged in quality and they were generally not as big. Beyond the Sword, of course, has the biggest mods, and the biggest success is the inclusion of Rise and Fall, Fall from Heaven, and Road to War, which are three fan-made mods, and all three of them are very big. It's a mark of success of the BTS mods that they have generated a lot of discussions on the forums. Particularly, it seems that Final Frontier and Road to War are the two most discussed mods. It's not something you could say for Vanilla Civ 4 or Warlords, so that is another very pleasant aspect.
Metropolitan University.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if people do want to learn how to play Civ better, there is a good way for competitive playing to have other people give you advice.
And we would find that where? Jeez.
Metropolitan.net
really?
Forums?
Wow, how could I figure that
out? I don't know.
Metropolitan University. Sometimes I wonder. Part 2 of 3 of Civilization 4 Gold Edition poster artist Greg Hildebrand. Interview. And just looking at a copy of what you painted, the thing that really strikes me, although my eye quickly obviously goes to Genghis Khan and Catherine, and then my eyes kind of go to the background to try to get the context of what exactly is going on, my eye then kind of goes to the lower right-hand corner, and just in front of the wheel for a cannon, the hand reaching out. I just kind of stare at that almost more than anything else. My eyes don't go to it first, but that's where my eye rests.
I love the challenge of that kind of a scene. When I say that kind of scene, I mean a lot of things going on, because the challenge is to keep a central focus and yet contain all this stuff. And what I fall back on generally is the ancient Greek idea of the golden rectangle and the positioning of objects. They had a whole formula in terms of where the primary center of interest should lay. And your eye goes there first, then you move the eye around in a circular form, almost a spiral around the whole picture plane. and you kind of like control that by placement of objects, and so things don't shoot off to the side or go out of a picture. It's a very controlled effort to lead you around the picture, probably for you ending up at that hand.
Exactly.
I remember when I first started that stuff, it would be like I'm reading books about that kind of stuff in terms of the approach to composition. At this point now, it's almost automatic. I don't really think about it as I draw, as I lay the scene out. It just draws itself in a way.
Oh, sure, you get kind of a mental image and you start thinking about it, and then before you know it, you've put so many pieces together that you're telling a story. Many stories really are going on in this painting.
Yeah. I love contrast of all kinds. I just like the juxtaposition of dark and light and color and character types. And in this case, really, the time juxtaposition, which was something I never painted before. And I've done a lot of science fiction stuff, but I've never painted these different periods of time all pulled together into one image. And I enjoyed painting the pyramids in their original form covered with limestone with the gold tops. Must have been a hell of a sight.
Yeah, and that's something that we don't get to see very much of, with the gold on top and then the limestone. That really strikes me. What was your experience with the Civ series, if any, prior to creating this illustration? Sounds like not much, but you'd heard of the series. But have you had any experience with the game since?
None whatsoever. You have to understand.
You have no time.
When I said I was a caveman, I honestly don't even know how to turn on a computer. I mean it. I'm not kidding. I generally say to the person, and I know nothing about computers, and they say to me, oh, yeah, well, I know. I say, no, you don't get it. No, you don't get it. I really don't know anything about computers. I know everything that I do is reproduced. It's my business manager, agent, she has a complete setup and hires people, you know, and I watch them work and do all the Photoshop and all that stuff. But I really don't know anything about computers. Honestly, this is a very dumb kind of thing.
Well, that's okay. I don't know hardly anything about drawing and painting. If they had asked me to create that poster, we'd have a bunch of stick figures. So I think it's just as well they contacted you because...
Well, you got to get, as much as I know nothing about computers, I'm blown away by what people do on computers in terms of art, whether that be still in the individual images or a film, special effects. It's like magic to me. It's incredible.
Well, and what you're able to put on paper is just as much magic to others, because, as I said, I know I couldn't do it.
Well, I've been doing this for a while. Every day you stumble through it and you figure it out.
Very true. Back to some of your other endeavors for a moment. Two of my fellow co-hosts here on Polycast, Wouter Snijders, who goes by Locutus on our forums, and Imran Siddiqui, are intense Harry Potter series fans. I dare not ask them who is more so.
Okay.
I notice on your official website, brothershildebrandt.com, illustrations for Harry Potter. What can you tell us about those?
Well, those are done for a card game initially. Jean, again, my business manager and agent, she's the one that got connected with the people that were managing that at the time and painted a lot of, I don't remember how many scenes, out of the storyline they had developed. I really enjoyed it. The films, I think, are incredible. I've never read the books.
I've never read the books, and I've never seen a movie either. I admit it, although I've been told I should.
No, that's okay. We did a lot of stuff for Magic the Gathering, of course. A lot of paintings, Tim and I. Starting to do some Warcraft stuff also. So we're kind of like all over the place, and I enjoy that.
As you said, the opportunity for new challenges, new things, to get your feet wet, get into the white space, as you said,
yep.
Which was the opportunity that you took to do this poster.
Exactly. That was it right there. The fact that I'd never done it was so extremely interesting to me. I like the idea that, hey, wait a minute, this thing might not come off. Thought that this thing may not work. So that's what makes it interesting to me. It's like discovering something.
Oh, yeah, discovering not just about the environment, but about yourself.
Yeah, all this stuff. Doing the civilization painting the superheroes, doing stuff for the Lord of the Rings. It's like I'm still a kid. I'm 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 years old, up in my bedroom, getting lost. I keep that feeling and that belief alive. You know, I tend to do it till whenever.
Yeah, I still get that reaction sometimes. Dan, you play computer games? How old are you?
Yeah, well...
But hey,
what's the age
as long
got to
as
do
you
it?
Feel.
It's that old thing, like, grow up, act your age. I used to get that all the time. Obviously, I come from another generation. It's like, what the hell does that mean?
From episode 23, recorded on August 18th with Dan Q, Wouter Locutus Snijders, Mark Metallic Turtle Anderson, Derek Kale Paxton, and Tony Garrett's Zach Akeel. Civ Army, how big is big enough?
No, I don't think there is any limit on how big an army can be. I shouldn't be.
It really depends on how much you need to compensate.
there's no number there. It's like all the great decisions in Civilization IV, there's good and a bad to it. If there was a direct answer to it, then the game would be very easy. You just build an army that size and you win.
I agree.
But since you have to pay a cost, there's an advantage and a disadvantage, just depending on the situation, which is what makes it a great game.
Good job, Kale.
I agree, too.
These discussions are always fun.
That's not interesting.
So we're all in agreement, then.
I'd even give 5 general recommendations, just to expand a little bit on it. The larger the map and the greater the difficulty level, the more units of many types you will need. Your map type can greatly determine your balance of military, naval, and air units, duh, and how many, i.e. the size of your army. As Derek was getting at. The key to a good offense is a good defense. Don't leave your cities with minimal defenses as you send out one or more units to one or more fronts. Because if another civilization starts attacking you, you may not be able to get back in time to defend the cities that you already have, and they may not be in very good condition even if they do get back in time. Know your enemy. Number 4, learn as much as you can about the type as well as the number of units. So you know about inherent attack and defense abilities, upgrades too even. And I think we talked about before, don't automatically upgrade your units instantly for similar reasons, even if they are shinier. Ding, ding. As the game progresses, you think you will need accompanying artillery units more and more, as with many collateral damage bonuses as you can muster in defense or offense, or city attack bonus as well if you're going on offense, because you've got individual unit building and one or fortifying defenses that are both helpful and hindering to you, depending upon whether you are attacking or being attacked.
I think it's interesting. You see two extremes for the players, and they both come and they complain about different aspects. One is the player that builds almost no army, and he complains that the AI gangs up on him because he'll get attacked by 3 or 4 different people at once. And on the other side, you have the player that fortifies his little empire and builds this huge army and complains because nobody ever comes and fights with him then because he's ready to receive them and they don't ever come in. And I don't think a lot of players realize that the Civ AI looks at the power rating. So it looks at how tough all your units are before it decides if it's going to go to battle with you, which is exactly what it should do. But yeah, they're going to come and they're going to pull apart the weak players and they're going to avoid attacking the powerful ones, which is the way you want it.
It's that darn strategy again, eh? Jeez.
Real-time strategy. Real time, but very slow.
Well, real time was actually pretty slow. This game goes over 4,000 years, so.
Well, yeah, you press one button and 30 years goes by. I see your point.
That's right.
I see someone has suggested with regards to Beyond the Sword, a particular strategy with invading of continents by having a couple of fake invasions at different spots before moving in your main one. Since the computer will move the bulk of its forces to deal with the fake invasions, and you just use them to pillage as much as possible before you die, whereas you have your main force then move in after the AI has moved out.
I use that one.
I think you could probably do that even before Beyond the Sword.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
It's a pretty smart strategy. It's also very realistic, right? You see these harassing forces moved in. That was exactly what their purpose was, to draw armies away from the cities and more strategically important places the empire you were invading. So I think it makes sense, and it's good that it works that way.
I used to be critical and say, well, what part of Civ isn't realistic? But it really came down to the fact that with generic style that Sid Meier's came up, a lot of Civ comes out to be realistic just because the things in this game are logically a lot of the ways that it'd be in real life, like resource allocations, plots, and units all being built with these resources of cities.
The gameplay trumps any reality that we want to have there, so it's more important that it's fun than it's realistic, but it's kind of nice when you get both of those things all at the same time. It's cool to see those correlations.
Time Machine Retrospective from Episode 9, recorded on February 17th, with Dan Q, Makalua, Imran, and Blake Walsh.
Alpha Centauri released in February of 99.
And I bought it even though I didn't have a computer that could run it.
Oh, that's passion right there.
Was that when you were first introduced to Shiny?
Shiny?
The Shiny box.
No, I still had my old 386 at the time.
What a heady time that was. And then everyone got it. And then some people said it was ugly. But yeah, the manual, I remember, was really impressive. Had all sorts of stats on planet.
I was impressed when I had flipped over to the bibliography and saw some of the things that they had read as background for figuring out how to set up some of the factions and things. And I was like, hey, I've read that too.
That's amazing. Yeah, they really did their research on that game.
Which is why people are still playing it 8 years later.
Well, there's lots and lots of fan fiction.
Ryan Reynolds' last turn-based game.
Because he went on to do
the real-time bastard.
No, real-time's not bad. Yay, real-time.
That was a very fun time in the Dream of Pulp. We just got massively invaded by hordes of pro and anti-smack people.
Hey, Alpha Centauri is what brought me here to Bolton. I mean, it was a couple of years after the Great Invasion, but...
Well, we have Alpha Centauri to thank for Maka, so it's all good.
Uh-huh.
Wait, who?
I said Maka.
Maka? Yeah.
I knew what he meant.
I'm abbreviating.
Poorly.
See, we're on familiar terms now, Dan.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Not that familiar.
No, after the show, we talk about how much you were horrible. And I was here for the big smack fun. It was a good time. I didn't get it early on, though. I think also I had the same thing with my computer, that it wasn't going to run it all that well. So I got it a little bit afterwards, but I was around and I was reading all of the fun.
I never really got as involved in the Alpha Centauri community specifically as I did with Civ.
Well, I only got into a failing crossfire, and then, of course, I was very active in the Alpha Centauri community, as anyone who's active in the forums even know.
Demo game.
Demo game.
And I also played Alpha Centauri all the time, all the while through Civ 3, because Civ 3 wasn't that good.
I also think one of the best things about Alpha Centauri was the story. It depends on how good of writers they have involved in it. If they're just going to rehash exactly the story of Alpha Centauri 1, it may not be as exciting as it could have been.
Especially not to the old players.
And with the storyline, the 35 chapters that were released online were really good, but I quite enjoyed the three-part series that Michael Eli put together afterwards.
I was in that online story, by the way. That's my one claim to fame.
You were?
Yes, by name. I was in with a Morgan storyline. Just one of them. I think he killed me, though.
Well, man.
That's no more than I deserve.
It's a tribute to the game that it inspired fiction like that. Like Civ 4 probably isn't going to, but it's a different type of game.
Definitely a game world that was conducive to storytelling.
There's some excellent stories in the AC Fiction forum now.
There are other forums.
Imran went no. King of off topic.
New topic. Is Dan nuts?
That's a new topic?
Well, we haven't written about it yet.
Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-659, 301-637-POLLY.
And for Europe, 44-020-7871-7659, 44-020-7871-POLLY.
Or you can Skype us at The Polycast.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
The official Polycast website, polycast.apolton.net.
Seriously, where is the hate mail address?
I guess it is closing time.
One last call for alcohol.
Yeah, I know the song.
Yes. Nah, he's thinking.
Oh, what, you haven't started
I
yet?
Quit.
He's thinking, I told you no singing.
Thank you for joining us, episode 24 of Polycast. Hopefully you had more fun listening to it than we had doing it. My name is Imran Siddiqui. Imran Siddiqui on the forums, obviously. I'm joined by Dan Q, unfortunately.
Goodbye.
Also, I'm joined by Makalua.
Bye, Dan.
Dan T.
Goodbye, everybody.
You did very well, even though you sounded too much like Dan Q. We'll have to deal with that. And also Ming, the Merciless. We were also on some portions of this podcast joined by Solver. Had some technical difficulties, probably because we live in Europe and we know about Europe.
Oh yeah, way to play to the European listeners there.
Well, maybe we'll get some calls.
More hate mail.
More hate mail.
or hate mail. I have not yet received hate mail.
I know.
I insult Mac users. I insult people from other countries. What the hell?
That brings up an interesting point there, Imran. As far as I'm aware, Dan T is currently recording on a Mac. He's using a Mac right now.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I just made the switch really recently.
I hadn't insulted Macs this time around. I don't know why.
Well, but now you can insult a Mac user next to in person, in real time. Go for it.
Yeah, we've already been doing this for about 2 hours.
Besides, he's afraid he's going to get Mac cooties.
Woodard could not join us today because he was looking at prawn and hurt himself. We can't go into further details.
Record date September 1st, 2007. Soundtrack courtesy Civilization IV Warlords and Beyond the Sword. Praise You by Fatboy Slim Clip, copyright Astral Works. Closing Time by Semisonic Clip, copyright MCA Records. Copyright 2007, a Bolton Civilization site at apolton.net.